Israelites wandering through the wilderness. And today our theme is the land. The land that God had promised and the land that his people are now to take possession of. But before we move forward in history, I want us to, for a moment, just cast a glance over our shoulders and look at the way that Israel has come to this point. And I'd like us to turn back to the promise to Abraham, and particularly as we find it in Genesis 12, verses 1 to 3. Now the Lord said to Abram, "Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." And I want us to see here that there are essentially three elements to this promise. First of all, God promises to Abraham and his descendants a land. "Go from your country and your kindred to the land that I will show you," verse 1. And secondly, he promises a great nation. "I will make of you a great nation," verse 2. And thirdly, the promise of blessing. "I will bless those who bless you," verse 3. "As you live under my rule, so you will experience my blessing upon your lives." So, in summary, this promise is that God's people will be in God's place under God's rule. But as we've seen already, there is a delay in the fulfillment of that promise. By the beginning of the book of Exodus, we're told that the small number who came up out of Egypt, who came to Egypt, are now a great multitude. So Exodus chapter 1 and verse 7, I'll just read it. "The Israelites were fruitful and prolific. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so that the land," that's the land of Goshen where they were living in Egypt, "was filled with them." So God is beginning to fulfill the promise. The promise that they will be a great nation is now being fulfilled, Exodus chapter 1 tells us. But they're in the wrong place, they're in Egypt, and they're under the wrong rule. They're under Pharaoh rather than God. And Exodus, the book of Exodus, shows us how God brings the people out of Egypt and frees them from slavery, and how he brings them to worship him on Mount Sinai and gives them his law, expressing how his rule is to be worked out in their lives. The law was never a ladder by which people were to climb into God's presence. The law is a God-given pattern for people who've been redeemed by the Lamb. That's why Exodus 19 and 20 come after Exodus 12. It's Exodus 12 where the redemption happens. It's as God's people that God gives them the law and a pattern for living under his rule. So the promise is being partially fulfilled, that promise to Abraham. Israel is becoming a great nation, they're God's people, and God has brought them out of Egypt and given them a pattern for life in which they can experience his blessing. So God's people are beginning to live under God's rule. But they're not yet in God's place. And the book of Deuteronomy, if you'd just like to turn to the end of that, it ends very tantalizingly with the Israelites on the very brink of the promised land. The sharper ones will notice that there aren't 15 verses in Deuteronomy 34. That should say Deuteronomy 34, 1-5. So here is Moses and the people of Israel on the brink of the promised land. Deuteronomy chapter 34 and verse 1. Then Moses went up from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo to the top of Pisgah, which is opposite Jericho. And the Lord showed him the whole land, Gilead as far as Dan, all Naphtali, the land of Ephraim and Manasseh, all the land of Judah as far as the western sea, the Negeb and the plain, that is the valley of Jericho, the city of palm trees, as far as Zoar. The Lord said to him, "This is the land of which I swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, saying, I will give it to your descendants. I have let you see it with your eyes, but you shall not cross over there." Then Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab at the Lord's command. So God has brought Israel through the wilderness. And now he says to Moses, here's the land. This is the land that I promised to Abraham back in Genesis chapter 12. Moses was not himself going to see it. You can see the background of that in Numbers chapter 20. But we're going to look today, first of all, at how the land was conquered under Joshua. Because, of course, the land was already occupied. So how is the land going to be occupied? How is the final part of God's promise to be fulfilled? Well, Joshua chapter 1 really sets the tone for the whole book. And in this first chapter of Joshua, God makes it very clear that Israel is going to enter the land, not because of their own military might, but because of the promise of God. Let's read the first six verses of Joshua. After the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord, the Lord spoke to Joshua, son of Nun, Moses' assistant, saying, "My servant Moses is dead. Now proceed to cross the Jordan, you and all this people, into the land that I am giving to them, to the Israelites. Every place that the sole of your foot will tread upon, I have given to you as I promised to Moses. From the wilderness and the Lebanon, as far as the great river, the river Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites to the great sea in the west shall be your territory. No one shall be able to stand against you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will not fail you or forsake you. Be strong and courageous, for you shall put this people in possession of the land that I swore to their ancestors to give them." Now, what you cannot fail to miss in these verses is the fact that it is God who gives the land. So verse 2, "Proceed into the land that I am giving to them, to the Israelites." And verse 3, "Every place that the sole of your foot will tread upon, I have given you." The land which the Israelites are entering is the gift of God in fulfillment of that promise to Abraham. So the Israelites will enter because of the promise of God and on the basis of covenant obedience. Verse 7, "Only be strong and very courageous, being careful to act in accordance with all the law that my servant Moses commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right hand or to the left, so that you may be successful wherever you go. This book of the law shall not depart out of your mouth. You shall meditate on it day and night so that you may be careful to act in accordance with all that is written in it. For then you shall make your way prosperous, and then you shall be successful. I hereby command you, be strong and courageous. Do not be frightened or dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. God is giving the land as a gift, but Joshua and the people are charged with this obligation to live under the covenant. We talked about covenant a couple of weeks ago. And that covenant relationship is expressed on the people's part in obedience. Trusting obedience is the way in which God's people are to enjoy his blessing. And so God says to Joshua very clearly, keep the word, keep the law in your mouth. You meditate on it day and night so that you may be careful to act in accordance with all that's written there. And as Joshua and the people trust the promise of God, and as they live in obedience, so they experience the presence of God. Verse 5, God says to Joshua, as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will not fail you or forsake you. And again, verse 9, do not be frightened or dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. You won't be alone as you summon up the courage to stay loyal and obedient to me, says God. The Lord, that is Yahweh, the covenant God, is with you wherever you go. And another theme that we see in this first chapter is that the land will be a place of rest. Verse 13. Remember the word that Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded you, saying, the Lord your God is providing you a place of rest and will give you this land. And again, verse 15, until the Lord gives rest to your kindred as well as to you, and they too take possession of the land that the Lord your God is giving them. Now, to say that the land will be a place of rest doesn't mean that it's a kind of a timeshare haven where you put up your feet and sit back and relax. Rest biblically means rest from enemies, knowing the security of living in God's place under God's rule. We're going to come back and think about rest later on. But rest is a key theme that we're going to see occurring again and again in these books. And each of these four themes we see illustrated by the rest of the book of Joshua. So I guess the most famous incident in the book of Joshua is the fall of Jericho, chapter 5, verse 13 to 6, 27. And there, God illustrates how he is going to give the land. He appears as the commander of the army of the Lord in the end of chapter 5. And then in chapter 6, verse 2, he says, see, I have handed Jericho over to you, along with its king and soldiers. And so, in obedience to God, the Israelites then walk around the city daily for 6 days. And then on the seventh day, they walk around 7 times. The priests blow their trumpets. And Joshua says to the people, shout, for the Lord has given you the city. The walls come tumbling down, and the city is destroyed. And as a footnote to the whole episode, chapter 6 and verse 27 says, so the Lord was with Joshua, and his fame was in all the land. So each of those themes are there in Jericho. Joshua trusting the promise of God, I've given you the land. Walking in obedience, literally walking around once a day around the city, and then 7 times on the seventh day. And as they do that, so Joshua experiences the presence of God. And then negatively, the story of Achan and Ai, they show the reverse what happens when Israel tries to do things when they're left to themselves. So chapter 7, verse 1, the Israelites broke faith in regard to the devoted things. And again, verse 11, where the Lord says to Joshua, Israel has sinned, they have transgressed my covenant that I have imposed on them. They have taken some of the devoted things, they've stolen, they've acted deceitfully, and they have put them among their own belongings. The command was that the city was to be totally destroyed, but the Israelites decided that they thought better than God. And the consequences of that are made clear in verse 12. Therefore, the Israelites are unable to stand before their enemies. They turn their backs to their enemies because they have become a thing devoted for destruction themselves. I will be with you no more unless you destroy the devoted things from among you. In other words, Israel will not be able to experience the land as a place of rest. And God here threatens to remove his presence from them. Now, the rest of this first section, up to the end of verse 12, describes how the south and the north of the land are captured. Just to see it on a map. It's a rather minimalist map, I'm afraid. But it gives you the general idea. If you can read those titles. Joshua came from the south and swept round into Jericho. That was the first city that was captured. Then to Ai. And then down to the south. And then they went up north. And Joshua chapters 1 to 12 are all about how the land was captured in that way. And then chapters 13 to 22 of Joshua describe how the land was divided. Chapter 13 records that there were still large swathes of land that were yet to be occupied and claimed by Israel. But the verdict of chapter 21 and verse 43 is that God's promise has now been fulfilled. Thus the Lord gave to Israel all the land that he swore to their ancestors that he would give them. And having taken possession of it, they settled there. And the Lord gave them rest on every side, just as he had sworn. Verse 45, not one of all the good promises that the Lord had made to the house of Israel had failed. All came to pass. So that summary verdict is saying God's promises are now fulfilled. The people are in God's place. And then the final section of the book from chapter 23 onwards are really showing how Joshua saw things. Here we have a covenant renewal ceremony where Joshua and the people renew their commitment to the covenant, and where Joshua is calling people back to faithfulness on the basis of God's faithfulness to them. God has fought for us, says Joshua. And verse 14, now I am about to go the way of all the earth, and you know in your hearts and souls, all of you, that not one thing has failed of all the good things that the Lord your God promised concerning you. All have come to pass for you. Not one of them has failed. But just as all the good things that the Lord your God promised concerning you have been fulfilled for you, so the Lord will bring upon you all the bad things, etc. Sorry, I got the wrong chapter, actually. I should be looking at 24:14. Now therefore revere the Lord and serve him in sincerity and in faithfulness. Put away the gods that your ancestors served beyond the river and in Egypt and serve the Lord. So calling people back to faithfulness and warning them against infidelity. Verse 27 of chapter 24, Joshua said to all the people, see, this stone shall be a witness against us, for it has heard all the words of the Lord that he spoke to us. Therefore it shall be a witness against you if you deal falsely with your God. So Joshua, the book of Joshua, comes to an end, and Joshua himself dies. But if Joshua has shown the faithfulness of God in fulfilling his promise, when we turn to the next book of the Bible, to the book of Judges, the focus turns from God to Israel. And the results are disastrous. Joshua's fear in that last chapter of Joshua that the people would forget their covenant obligations is borne out by the opening chapters of the book of Judges, which speak of covenant failure. Now, you know how some preachers repeat themselves. Well, they do it usually to make a point. And as you read through the first chapter of Judges, you get the feeling that the writer is trying to make a point. So, chapter 1 and verse 27. Manasseh, that's one of the tribes or the half-tribes of Israel, did not drive out the inhabitants of Beth Shean and its villages. Verse 28, when Israel grew strong, they put the Canaanites to forced labor, but did not in fact drive them out. Ephraim, another of the tribes, did not drive out the Canaanites who lived in Giza. Zebulun, verse 30, did not drive out the inhabitants of Kitron. Asher, verse 31, did not drive out the inhabitants of Akko. Verse 32, the Asherites lived among the Canaanites. They did not drive them out. Verse 33, Naphtali did not drive out the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh. Now you're beginning to get the point. The writer is wanting to say something to us here. The tribes of Israel have failed to drive out completely the Canaanites, the inhabitants of the land. But why should he be so concerned? Clearly, these inhabitants were not a military threat. Some of those verses talk about the Israelites putting them to forced labor. The Israelites were clearly in control. They were successful. But they had failed to drive out the inhabitants of the land. And the reason that the author is so concerned is not so much that they posed a military threat as a spiritual threat. God had warned Israel through Moses in Exodus 23 that they must drive out the people of the land. They shall not live in your land, says God to Moses, or they will make you sin against me. For if you worship their gods, it will surely be a snare to you. That is the reason why Israel was to eliminate the Canaanites. And in her failure to do so, Israel was guilty of disobedience. And after the death of Joshua, the new generation of Israelites abandoned the Lord, chapter 2 and verse 11. The Israelites did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and worshipped the Baals. And they abandoned the Lord, the God of their ancestors, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt. They followed other gods from among the gods of the people who were all around them and bowed down to them. And they provoked the Lord to anger. So here is a people who, for all their success, all their apparently being in control, have brought God to deep anger on account of their apostasy, turning away from the true God to the gods who live in the land. And they face, therefore, the judgment of God. Chapter 2 and verse 20. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, And he said, because this people have transgressed my covenant that I commanded their ancestors and have not obeyed my voice, I will no longer drive out before them any of the nations that Joshua left when he died. So God now is withdrawing the opportunity of securing permanent military victory over the Canaanites. The Canaanites, says God, from now on will remain as a test to Israel. Well, the next section from 3:7 to the end of chapter 16 are really the core of the book of Judges. And they contain the exploits of the great heroic figures of the time who are raised up by the Lord one by one to save or deliver Israel, and who then judge Israel for the rest of their lives. We tend to use the word judge in a narrow judicial sense, but when we talk about judges in the book of Judges, we're talking about someone who rules or governs, an administrator. Not in the Marion Cameron sense, but somebody who rules the whole country and who brings deliverance. And the 12 judges that we read about, they rule on behalf of the Lord, who is the ultimate judge of Israel. Chapter 11, verse 27, talks about the Lord, the judge. Now, as you read through the book of Judges and see these different characters, it's very clear that they are a very diverse group of people. I want tonight briefly to look at the first of the judges, Othniel, and just see the pattern that is set by his story, because in many ways this pattern is repeated again and again through the period of the judges. And the pattern goes like this. Chapter 3, verse 7 and 8. Israel's infidelity and God's anger. So the Israelites, says verse 7, did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, forgetting the Lord their God, and worshipping the Baals and the Asherahs. Therefore the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he sold them into the hand of King Cushan-Rishathaim of Aram Naharaim, and they served him. So, in the distress of their captivity, the Israelites abandon the Lord and they worship foreign gods. And God's anger is roused. He won't allow his people to serve Baal. Rather, he pursues them in his steadfast love. And he's not above inflicting misery in order to wake them up to what's really happening. That is the way that God's love is expressing itself for his people here. In his anger, he is selling them into captivity. But then the second stage of the pattern is Israel's cry and God's rescuer, verse 9. But when the Israelites cried out to the Lord raised up a deliverer for the Israelites who delivered them, Othniel, son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother. So the Israelites cry out to God for help. Wasn't so much a cry of repentance, as simply a cry of anguish. Please help me, God. And in response to their anguish, God raised up a deliverer, a rescuer, this man, Othniel. And then the third stage of the pattern, Israel's oppressor and God's power, chapter 3 and verse 10. The Spirit of the Lord came upon Othniel, and he judged Israel. He went out to war, and the Lord gave King Cushan-Rishathaim of Aram into his hand. So the emphasis here is on God's Spirit coming on Othniel and through him defeating the oppressor. The God of Israel is the sovereign Lord. He's the Lord over every nation and over every power. And again through the book of Judges, he is delivering his people from oppression through a human rescuer. And then the fourth stage, Israel's opportunity and God's gift, chapter 3 and verse 11. So the land had rest, again that word rest, for 40 years. Then Othniel, son of Kenaz, died. So the land enjoyed rest from oppression and attack. That was the rest that God had promised to Joshua, the kind of blessing that Israel could enjoy if only she were prepared to live under God's rule. But then the judge dies, and sadly the pattern is repeated again and again through the book. And it is a downward spiral of captivity and infidelity. The Israelites failing to enjoy the blessing of the land because they repeatedly reject their covenant king. And to see the extent to which Israel fell, the final few chapters of the book give us some very telling insights into the life of Israel at the time of the judges. And this section turns away from the limelight of heroes like Gideon and Samson and shows us what life under the judges was like for ordinary men and women. And it's a picture of total disarray, religiously, politically, morally and socially. Israel is in chaos. But these chapters also begin to announce a remedy. Chapter 17 and verse 6. In those days there was no king in Israel. All the people did what was right in their own eyes. And that same phrase is repeated almost word for word in 18:1 and 19:1 and again in 21 and verse 25. So the moral and spiritual decadence of Israel, the writer puts down to the fact that there was no king in Israel. If there had been a king, he seems to suggest, a king who would uphold God's covenant standards, then things would clearly have been different. But the verdict is that Israel is out of control. Everyone was doing right in their own eyes. There was no authority. Every man and every woman was their own authority. And it's a verdict that's confirmed when you move forward to 1 Samuel. Samuel is really the last of the judges. And these early chapters of 1 Samuel give a picture of Israelite life during Samuel's time. And it's a picture of corrupt worship. Chapter 2 and verse 12 of 1 Samuel. Now the sons of Eli were scoundrels. They had no regard for the Lord or for the duties of the priests to the people. The sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, they treated the worship of the Lord with contempt. And because of that, they experienced divine judgment. Chapters 4 to 6. These two men, Hophni and Phinehas, die as a sign of God's displeasure. And then even worse, the Ark of the Covenant, the sign of God's presence with his people, is captured by the Philistines in battle. And Phinehas' widow gives birth after she's learnt of her husband and her father-in-law's death. And as she was about to die, chapter 4 and verse 20, the women attending her said to her, "Do not be afraid, for you have borne a son." But she did not answer or give heed. She named the child Ichabod, meaning the glory has departed from Israel. Because the ark of the God had been captured, and because of her father-in-law and her husband, she said, "The glory has departed from Israel, for the ark of God has been captured." So that presence that God had promised to Joshua, "I will be with you," here in 1 Samuel, the verdict is the glory, the presence of God has departed. But even in these bleak days, there is hope. And there is no more hopeful story than the story of Ruth, which speaks very powerfully of the loyalty of God. It's a story that you know well, and it's a story that reminds us that the purposes of God are not thwarted, even by the turmoil of the period of the judges, nor by the personal tragedy of Naomi. Remember this woman in a foreign land, her husband and her two sons died. She's in an extremely vulnerable position. But through this very real human tragedy, God is bringing back the ancestors of Christ to Bethlehem. Even when God feels absent, even in the tragedy of death and loss, God is working out his purposes. As you read through the book of Ruth, you ask the question, where is God? You read chapter 1 and think, well, where is God in all of this? And yet, through this story, God is working out his purposes. And to jump forward many centuries, if there was ever a moment in history when it looked as though God was absent, it was the death of Christ. And yet through that tragedy, God's purposes were being fulfilled. And this very human story of Ruth, set right in the midst of this national turmoil, is a reminder to us who live on the other side of the cross that God is involved in our lives, even when the evidence sometimes suggests otherwise. In the tragedies of unemployment and illness, bereavement, God is there. He is the covenant God, the God who is faithful to the promises that he's made. The God of our fathers, the God of Abraham, he will be faithful. And while we end on a low note here, in many ways, this whole period makes us want to look forward to a Saviour who will not be the imperfect people like Samson and Gideon, but a perfect rescuer who will deliver God's people once and for all, not just for a few years.